WHYY is proudly supported by Penn Medicine. From groundbreaking discoveries to life-saving care, Penn Medicine's innovation is helping to change lives, one moment, one treatment, one patient at a time.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. The carnage of the Civil War was an enormous emotional and physical burden for the poorly educated, inadequately trained, and ineffectually organized physicians of the era, writes my guest, Ira Rutko. The doctors of that time knew nothing about microorganisms and how they spread disease. Antibiotics were not yet invented, hospitals were unsanitary, and doctors often did as much to spread disease and infection as to stop them. Rutko's new book, Bleeding Blue and Gray, is about how medicine was practiced during the Civil War and how medical institutions changed as a result of the war. Ira Rutko is a clinical professor of surgery at the University of Medicine and Dentistry of New Jersey and is general editor of an 11-volume series on Civil War medicine. In his new book, Bleeding Blue and Gray, Rutko writes about the Battle of Bull Run, known in the South as Manassas, which killed 750 people and wounded 2,494, with more than 1,500 missing. What were some of the ways that doctors were unprepared to deal with this kind of massive number of people killed and wounded?
Well, you use the most important word that really sort of is the theme of the book, and that is unprepared. It's just that doctors, as they existed back then, were unprepared. There was a medical department of the United States Army, which was incredibly small. I think the number was 80 physicians at the start of the Civil War to take care of all the casualties, and they added numbers of physicians slowly. But at the time of Bull Run, there was just a total lack of preparedness. No one had any expectation that so many people were going to be shot and wounded and dying, and they lay there for days on the battlefield. There were no ambulances. There were no physicians who were told what to do. One of the quotes in the book says, it's like a time when there was no king. No one knew anything. That's what the problem was with the beginnings of Civil War medicine.
There's a quote I'd like you to read by William Williams Keene, who was an assistant surgeon for the 5th Massachusetts Infantry. And he worked out of a makeshift hospital in a church. And I think this describes really beautifully what medicine was like during the Civil War. Would you read this quote for us, but first introduce the context?
Oh, I would love to read this quote. This is a wonderful passage from a book that William Williams Keene wrote. He was a Philadelphia surgeon. And I stress the word surgeon because it's vastly different when you and I think of a surgeon today than what it was back in 1860s. William Keene was asked to become a surgeon to a Massachusetts regiment. And I can only tell you that Williams Keene had been in medical school for 4 months when he was asked to become the surgeon of this entire regiment. So in other words, when you were shot or if you needed your arm amputated, you were going to somebody who had been in medical school. And we're not talking about residency or internship. He had been in medical school for exactly 4 months. So this is William Keene's story of Civil War medicine, which he wrote approximately 20 years after the end of the Civil War. And this is the quote. We operated in old blood-stained and often pus-stained coats. We operated with clean hands in the social sense, but they were undisinfected hands. We used undisinfected instruments from undisinfected plush-lined cases, and still worse, used marine sponges which had been used in prior pus cases and had only been washed in tap water. If a sponge or an instrument fell on the floor, it was washed and squeezed in a basin of tap water and used as if it were clean. If there was any difficulty in threading the needle, we moistened it with saliva and rolled it between bacteria-infected fingers. We dressed the wounds with clean but undisinfected sheets, shirts, tablecloths, or other old soft linens rescued from the family rag bag. That is the essence, that's the end of the quote, that's the essence of Civil War surgery, certainly at the beginning of the war.
What were some of the misunderstandings about how diarrhea and typhus were spread, and those were really epidemic on the field in the Civil War?
Well, the misunderstandings were very similar to the surgical problems, and that was a total lack of knowledge of understanding about bacteria and germs, so that they would use dirty water. They would use water that people had bathed in, that people had defecated in, they had urinated in, they had gone to a stream. And upstream people had used it for their daily whatever. They were bathing, they were washing clothes, and that stream came down a few yards, and they would use that water to go ahead and cook food with. So they were just passing things on to one another. I mean, we're talking literally about millions of cases of diarrhea, millions of cases of dysentery.
What did the doctors think was causing the diarrhea and the dysentery?
They had no idea. They came up with all sorts of opinions. I remember one of the things I read was it was the cold air was causing it. Another one was that the men were sleeping too close to one another. Third was the fact that they slept in tents where they didn't raise the sides of the tents each day. So they had all these myths about what was causing diseases, but they didn't have fundamental understanding of what disease even was.
What was the state of surgery? So many of the wounded soldiers required amputations. What were amputations like then?
It was something that you and I would not want to participate in. It was not a fun event for the soldiers or for the doctors. Back then, speed was the essence of amputations. And the reason was that anesthesia had just been developed in about a decade and a half before. Not everybody had anesthesia available. So it was very often that you would undergo an operation. There might not be anesthesia. And even then, the types and amount of anesthesia they had often was not quite adequate. And it was a speed event because the doctor or the surgeon had to cut off the extremity, be it the arm or the leg or the finger or the toe, as soon as possible because the patient was screaming, was in agony. And you read excerpts from their diaries and from journals of amputation of an extremity in 90 seconds. I mean, it's unbelievable in today's world that they could do an entire amputation in 90 seconds. But it was different than what you and I perceive today of an amputation.
What were the odds of surviving a surgical amputation?
That's a great question, and everybody always asks that, and I don't have an answer. I can tell you that there were tens of thousands of amputations that were done. We're looking at certain battles where literally hundreds were done in a given day. But I've never seen a statistic of the actual number of people who survived. In other words, how many people became infected. Usually once they became infected, then survival was lessened. And I've never seen a real number on the actual percentages of the people who survived. I would imagine that it was somewhere 50% at best.
You say gangrene was one of the most feared complications for soldiers who were wounded. Why?
Well, there was this entity called hospital gangrene. And hospital gangrene is a disease entity that we do not have today. It doesn't exist. So we don't really know exactly what it was, but it was a massive infection. They talk about it spreading at the rate of an inch an hour on a soldier's body. And you could literally watch the gangrene spread up the soldier's leg or his arm at an inch an hour. And the tissue was just dying. It was probably some type of mixed bacterial infection that would have been easily treated today with antibiotics. But back then, they never heard of the word antibiotics. They had no idea about bacteria. And all they knew what to do was to try and stay ahead of the disease that was advancing. So if the disease was up to the middle of your calf, they would cut up to below your knee. So they would try and stop the disease. Sometimes it worked, sometimes it didn't work. In addition, one of the other treatments was after they did the operation, they would pour nitric acid or other things onto the tissue to try and stop the spread of the disease. Sometimes it was a question of who was going to win the battle. The surgeons were melting away tissue. They were cutting away tissue. The bacteria were doing their thing. It was, in essence, you never really knew who was going to win, but it was a horrible disease process and was easily spread not only from soldier to soldier, but also from soldier to physician, soldier to nurse, soldier to caregivers. It was just a mess.
What were some of the disagreements within the medical profession about how to treat injuries and illness?
I think that was one of the most fascinating things I learned about American medicine at the time. American medicine in the 19th century, certainly up through the 1870s, and maybe even into the 1880s, was a very contentious profession. And I use the word profession very lightly because, I mean, I'm not even sure it was a profession yet in the classic sense. People fought with one another. The surgeons just tended to be very feisty. They were very divisive. They fought with one another constantly about all sorts of things. It was a time of, you know, democracy in America and individualism, and it was a time of independence. So throughout the 19th century, you had this core of doctors who grew up with one another were constantly arguing with one another. One of the reasons was because it was so unscientific and there was no science involving medicine. They couldn't prove or disprove anything. No one had any idea what was going on. So whatever you said was as legitimate as what the next person said. So the problem was they argued about everything. There was nothing that they didn't argue about. They argued about the way that you did amputations. They argued about when the amputations were done. They argued about whether how you should treat the diarrhea or the dysentery. And the bottom line was no one was right. Everybody was wrong because they didn't understand the very basis of science of medicine.
My guest is Ira Rutko, author of the new book Bleeding Blue and Gray. We'll talk more about Civil War medicine after a break. This is Fresh Air. If you're just joining us, my guest is physician and medical historian Ira Rutko, and his new book is called Bleeding Blue and Gray, Civil War Surgery and the Evolution of American Medicine. Let's talk a little bit about the nurses who worked in the Civil War hospitals. They were led by Dorothea Dixon. What were their jobs like?
The nurses' jobs were nothing that you and I, again, could imagine in today's world. One of the reasons was that nursing schools didn't exist. At least at the time, they were medical schools. But nursing schools didn't exist. And the concept of a nurse is vastly different in 1860s and Civil War medicine than anything that we can think of today. If you were a wife and your husband had been shot and you went down to the hospital to find him and to hopefully take care of him, you then became a nurse. You were given the title of nurse. So that women who were washing women, who followed the troops around and washed the clothing, they were entitled nurse. In addition, there was a formal group led by Dorothea Dix, as you said, a United States Nursing Corps established by the government, and she recruited nurses, but there were really not many of them, maybe 100 or 200 who served during the course of the war. The vast majority of nurses were people who volunteered on their own, went down to the various hospitals, went to work in the hospitals. It was this amorphous group. It wasn't a real fixed group. And they think that approximately 3,000 to 5,000 women served as nurses throughout the Civil War. But again, their duties were vastly different than what you and I know today.
Two of the people who served as nurses on a volunteer basis, as you're describing, were Louisa May Alcott, who wrote Little Women, and the great poet Walt Whitman. How much did they write about their Civil War experiences?
Well, Louisa May Alcott wrote an awful lot that came out of the Civil War. Many of her books portrayed her time as a nurse at the Union Square Hospital. It was not really a long time that she was in service. She was only there for approximately 2 or 3 weeks and then left. Her father brought her back. Walt Whitman went to search for his brother, who he thought had been shot. It ended up that the brother was fine and had not really been wounded much. And Walt Whitman ended up staying in Washington area for maybe 1 to 2 years, taking care of the wounded, writing back to his newspaper, the Brooklyn Eagle, daily reports of what was happening with the war. So Whitman was there much longer than Louisa May Alcott.
Well, she got sick, and that's one of the reasons why she left. She got very sick.
She got
sick.
Horribly sick. She was at this hospital. She got very, very sick. The woman who had, who was her, what they called her matron, Hannah Ropes, who I also write about, she had instructed Louisa May Alcott on what to do, what not to do. Louisa May Alcott lasted approximately 2 weeks before she came down with what was either dysentery or typhoid. No one really knows what everybody was having back then. But she became deathly ill and almost died. And Hannah Ropes, the woman who was recruiting her and who was her matron, died the day that Louisa May Alcott's father took Louisa May Alcott back to Massachusetts.
Although there weren't really any breakthroughs during the Civil War in the way of antibiotics or anesthesia or an understanding of germs, there were breakthroughs in terms of sanitary conditions. And you credit a lot of that to the Sanitary Commission, which was run by Frederick Law Olmsted.
Yes.
And before we go any further with him, maybe you could read a quote in which he described the conditions that he faced in the war.
Well, this is a quote, and Frederick Law Olmsted was writing to Henry Bellows, who had sort of founded the United States Sanitary Commission. The Sanitary Commission was a philanthropic group. It was not involved with the military. It was not involved with the federal government. It was a volunteer group that was going to help the soldiers, the wounded soldiers, to provide sort of home-like conditions at the time of the battles. They were going to provide food and basics that they needed. And if they were shot, they were going to provide medical things. And Olmsted was on the what they called the peninsula at the time, which was in Virginia. And it was in the middle of a very bad campaign. Many of the Union soldiers had been shot. And this was in the days following the Battle of Fair Oaks. And I quote, "At the time of which I am now writing, Monday afternoon, wounded were arriving by every train, entirely unattended, or with at most a detail of two soldiers to a train of 200 or 300 of them. They were packed as closely as they could be stowed in the common freight cars, without beds, without straw, at most with a wisp of hay under their heads. They arrived, dead and alive together, in the same closed box, many with awful wounds, festering and alive with maggots. The stench was such as to produce vomiting with some of our strong men, habituated to the duty of attending the sick and wounded of the army." End of quote. And that was what army life was for the wounded following a major battle. They were all packed in cars. They were shipped together. They gave one another an infection. If one had been shot and his wound got infected, then the next one got it. They all touched one another. Same dressing, same sponges as we had discussed previously.
And that was a description written by Frederick Law Olmsted, who headed the Sanitary Commission. What did Olmsted go on to become famous for?
Well, Olmsted actually was famous almost already at the time of the Civil War. He was a young man. He was in his 30s when they asked him. And I have to preface everything by saying that all the men in this book, other than for the nurses who were the women, all the men were very young. Even Louisa May Alcott, they were in their 20s when they went to war. The Surgeon General of the United States Army was 32. Olmsted was in his 30s. He was famous already at that time because they had planned and were in the process of developing Central Park in New York City. And he was the major designer and organizer and ran the construction crews that were designing that. And he went on after the war to become very famous as a landscape architect.
So what did the Sanitary Commission under Olmsted's direction do to improve the conditions at the Civil War hospitals?
Well, I think very specific things were done by the Sanitary Commission. They were able to, for whatever reason, bring in supplies, both medical and non-medical supplies, to the battles before the federal government was able to get things in. And in fact, Olmsted often writes to his wife, Mary, that he says he's most proud of the fact that he was able to get shiploads and car and freight loads of railroad cars into battlefield sites before the federal government was able to get their own supplies in. And the reason was because the members of the Sanitary Commission, men like Olmsted and Bellows and other people who were running it, stayed on top of the situation. They sent their literally spies and other people out to find out where they thought the next battle was going to be. And they made sure that if the battle was going to, let's say, be near Richmond, in the next month or so, they began stockpiling things sort of near that area so they could rush them into the battlefield right after the battle. So the Sanitary Commission proved very, very important in terms of organizing and helping the troops both before, during, and after the battle.
You described that there were breakthroughs in hospital design during the Civil War as people started to pick up on the suggestions that Florence Nightingale had made earlier. What were some of those suggestions that were adopted in the States?
Well, I found out in my readings and my research that prior to the Civil War, hospitals, as you and I know, really didn't exist. They were very small places, log cabins often. They were almshouses. The poor went to the hospitals to die. There was no great hospitals where there were all these scientific discoveries where you went to get the latest and greatest in medical knowledge. That just didn't exist. But eventually, throughout the course of the Civil War, they began to realize they needed to have hospitals. And this concept came about directly related to Florence Nightingale and her experience in the Crimean War of what they call pavilion hospitals. And pavilion hospitals are the forerunner to what you and I know as the large modern hospital of today. Pavilion hospitals were these immense structures that could hold 2,000 and 3,000 men at a time, where they would have a central corridor, an office corridor, would be radiating these huge pavilions that could hold 80 or 100 men. And they might have 20 or 30 of these pavilions sort of based around this core. And this concept of cleanliness and that things had to have air flow through it, and that you needed to have less dirt, so they reduced the number of right angles in these buildings. These were all concepts that came out of the Civil War. And eventually, they led to the building of the great hospitals in America that started in the 1880s and the 1890s that now we perceive as the modern American hospital.
Now, you said that there weren't really medical breakthroughs during the Civil War. There were breakthroughs in sanitary conditions, but no real new medical discoveries. But not long after the Civil War, there were breakthroughs in antibiotics and understanding of microorganisms. Was the Civil War connected in any way to those breakthroughs, even though it didn't happen at that time?
No, and I write that it was very sad for what happened during the Civil War, because the Civil War, 1861 to 1865, came about at the time where we were on this cusp of the scientific revolution in medicine. But that scientific revolution did not really come about until the 1870s into the 1880s. So that Civil War medicine, again, in the 1860s, was almost the same as what had been practiced in the 1500s, in the 900s, in the 200s, and in the B.C.s. And that's the sad part about the Civil War. If it had happened 10 to 15 years later, you would have seen dramatic changes in the way that people were being taken care of.
Ira Rutko, thank you so much for talking with us.
You're very, very welcome.
Ira Rutko is the author of the new book, Bleeding Blue and Gray, Civil War Surgery and the Evolution of American Medicine. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.